Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Siobhan Mukherjee, the host of New Books in Law. Today we'll be talking to Professor Robert P. Burns about his new work, Kafka's Law, The Trial in American Criminal Justice. Professor Burns is a professor of law at Northwestern University School of Law. Professor Burns, welcome to the show.
It's good to be here.
I wonder if you'd begin the interview by saying a few words about yourself, where you were born, where you went to school, and how you became attracted to studying criminal justice and legal literature.
Okay, I grew up in New York City, actually, in the neighborhood at the top end of Manhattan Island, Inwood, part of Washington Heights. I went to Fordham College and then went to law school at the University of Chicago Law School and got a PhD in the humanities, mainly philosophy of law, at the University of Chicago. Then I started working as a lawyer in Chicago.
Okay, great. Could you tell us now how you came to write your current work, Kafka's Law?
Yeah, I suppose I should say that my legal practice in Chicago, I started out doing largely civil rights law and welfare law with the local legal aid organization here in Chicago. And then I went to to Northwestern University, and I worked in their legal clinic. And in that capacity, I did a lot of criminal law. I represented criminal defendants in the criminal court and in post-conviction habeas cases, and did that a large part of my practice for about 15 years. So I got interested in the actual workings of the criminal justice system from the inside because I was working as a criminal defense lawyer here in Chicago during that time. I had been interested in studying that, and I did at the University of Chicago. Great professor there, Norville Morris, very well known as a criminologist. Hans Zeisel was also there. So I had some academic background in that area, but really came to be engaged with it in my experience as a criminal defense lawyer. And there was a bit of serendipity in it. I had written a couple of other books about the American trial. One was called The Theory of the Trial, and another one called The Death of the American Trial, which was about the disappearance or vanishing of the trial. And so I thought I should pick up Kafka's classic work on the trial and did that. And at the same time, it just by happenstance, I was asked to give a seminar to the Illinois state judges. And a topic that we came upon as the topic for that seminar, and there were hundreds of Illinois state judges, was Kafka's The Trial. There was in Chicago at that time. Well, in Chicago at that time a little group, a troupe, that was performing a dramatized version of Kafka's The Trial. So I got in touch with them, and we put on a dramatized version of the trial before all the judges, and I sort of created the commentary for that. Session for the Illinois judges. So as I did that, I was drawn more and more into the world of Franz Kafka. And there is, by the way, I should probably mention, there's a classic Orson Welles film of the trial, and it's he takes a lot of liberties with the text, but it you do get some sense of the power of the novel from Orson Welles' version of it in the theater. He himself, Orson Welles, plays the part of Huld the lawyer. We'll talk about him, I guess, in a few minutes. But it's an imaginative representation of the Kafka's The Trial.
That's fascinating, isn't it? We don't have to dwell on this too long, but I find connecting law to theater very interesting. I think that's very cool that you put on a play about the trial.
Yeah. There is, and it's still a good it's a good way to sort of get yourself into the text of the trial by looking at the Orson Welles film.
Okay. Could you briefly now describe the plot of the trial and give us some background about when it was written and by whom?
Okay. The trial is written by Franz Kafka. Franz Kafka is one of the great literary geniuses of the 20th century. He wrote in German. He was educated in German schools, although he himself came from a Jewish background. His father rose up in the Jewish peasantry in Central Europe, in Bohemia near Prague. His father became a store owner, storekeeper, and then Franz Kafka, the young Kafka, went to study law, and he was born in 1883. He received a doctorate in law at the local university in Prague, and was sort of active in literary circles. He wrote just a few short stories actually that were published during his lifetime. And he went to work for what was called the Workers' Accident Insurance Corporation after he got his doctorate in law. And that was a quasi-government or semi-government organization that had characteristics of our own Social Security Administration and OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. So they both paid out benefits to injured workers. During this time, there was factories and industry were being built in Central Europe for the first time, and those as in the United States, those new factories had very few safety precautions in them. Many workers were injured in the course of doing industrial work there in the new factories in Central Europe, and one of the functions of that organization that Kafka worked in. And he worked there for about 14 years, a very, very well-regarded employee. His bosses refused to allow him to be drafted into the First World War because they said he was just too indispensable as a lawyer for that organization. So the organization paid out benefits to disabled employees, but also like our OSHA, they engaged in some degree of regulation of the workplaces so as to try to make the workplaces safer than they would otherwise be. And he did that work for a long time, wrote lots of memos on a policy level, adjudicated some of the individual cases. And in that world, he really did come to know what the world of the law was like and also what the world of bureaucracy was like. So he understood bureaucracy from the inside. In his function of working for a quasi-bureaucratic organization. He wrote the trial just as the First World War was beginning in 1914 to 1915. And the trial, together with, was never published in his lifetime, and nor were either of his other two novels. They were left incomplete at his death. He died of tuberculosis in 1924 and at a very early age. And those manuscripts were edited into the form we have them now by his friend Max Brod, who was a friend and literary associate of his. So they were never published in his lifetime, and just before his death, he left what might have been a half-hearted request that the manuscripts be destroyed after he died. So they weren't really meant for publication in any kind of specific way. W. H. Auden, the great poet, said that Kafka was to his century much like Dante was to his, or Shakespeare was to his, that is, the artist who most comprehensively describes his era and the world that human beings at that time were creating for themselves and in which they in which they lived. So that's the background to the work. It's often been said that none of these novels, and especially the trial is the manuscript that looks most like a novel. It has a beginning, middle, and end. But if you really look at them from the inside, what they're like actually is a series of parables, and the various chapters, they were organized into chapters by Mr. Broad, really are one parable after another, where the same issues are played out in different sorts of keys as the novel progresses. So that's the background to the writing of the trial. I should say that Kafka's works are always thought to be extremely grim and perverse. Our word Kafkaesque captures that. But many of them are very funny. The trial, many of the chapters and scenes in the trial are enormously funny, even though it's often a black humor. When Kafka read the first chapter of his work to his friends for the first time, they were all laughing so hard that he had just had to stop. They were tears of laughter were welling up in his eyes, despite the sort of grim subject matter of the text.
Let's connect this now to the American criminal justice system. Would you tell us what Justice Anthony Kennedy has said about the connections between the trial and the American legal system?
Yeah, what he said was, I'll just quote him: "The trial is actually closer to reality than to fantasy, as far as the client's perception of the system. It's supposed to be a fantastic allegory, but it's reality. It's very important that lawyers read it and understand this." So those were Kennedy's words. I think that is quite true. Would you like me to describe in sort of broad outline the plot of the trial? Would that be helpful?
Sure, that would be very helpful.
Okay, so it begins on the 30th birthday of the protagonist, who's Joseph K. And he wakes up from a night's sleep, and two people are in his room. Two men are in his room, and they inform him that they are there to arrest him. They identify themselves as two guards, is the translation we have, whose names are Wilhelm and Franz. Well, Wilhelm and Franz are the names of the emperors and the kaisers of Austria-Hungary and Prussia, who were about to plunge Europe into the nightmare of the First World War. So Wilhelm and Franz show up in his bedroom. And the notion is that Joseph K. is just emerging from his sleep. He has that kind of weak lack of control of his life that we have when we're just sort of half asleep. We're just emerging from the world of dreams and the world of nightmares. And then this encounter with these two guys show up, and they are both funny and venal. They eat his breakfast. They say, "Why don't you give us your clothes? Because if you go down to the jail, your best clothes are going to be taken. So why don't you give them to us?" And so they're kind of scraping to get some kind of individual personal advantage out of this episode. Joseph K. says, "Why are you here? I'm innocent. I haven't done anything wrong." And they say, "Well, do you know what the law prohibits?" Joseph K. says, and this is a theme for the entire book, "No, I don't know what the law prohibits." And they say, "How can you be innocent? If you don't know what the law provides, you can't know that you're innocent. You must feel guilty about something, don't you? And you've probably violated the law, haven't you?" And so the guards have this conversation with him, and then he's interrogated by a visiting magistrate, and he basically says to Joseph, "Well, you must feel guilty about something. How can you just proclaim your innocence?" And so there's the beginning of this theme that we're all guilty of something or other, and the political process can take advantage of our in a sense, legitimate feeling of guilt about things that we've done in our lives, but which a certain kind of regime can take advantage of. So that's the first scene. Then Joseph is told that he's going to have a hearing, and the hearing is on a Sunday, so there's this play about the law's religious function, the relationship between the law and religion, and the collapse of the distinction between secular law on the one hand and religion and the other, as well as the collapse between the rational world of law on the one hand and our own sort of murky psychological guiltiness on the other. So he shows up for this hearing. He's late. So again, a sort of nightmare quality. I don't know if you've had the nightmare in which you're late for something you have to be to, and most people have had that. So he's late and he can't quite find it. The address is not clear as to where it is. It ends up being in the top floor. The court sits in the top floor of this tenement building. And again, the notion here is the law isn't distinct from the ordinary social realities of life. There aren't clear lines between one thing and another. The law is ubiquitous. It's everywhere. The law is, so the hearing itself takes place in this large room on the top floor of this tenement. So he walks in there, and he is late. The magistrate upbraids him for being late. He takes an initially kind of arrogant position. I haven't done anything wrong. You guys are just persecuting me for no reason. And there, in front of the magistrate, there's a large audience that looks like a group of lay jurors, we might say. And half of the audience on the right side are strongly on his side. When he criticizes the court, they cheer. When he tells a joke, they laugh. And he thinks to himself, well, this is going pretty well. I'm able to convince this jury that I haven't done anything wrong, and they're on my side. These are ordinary people I can trust. And then he goes down into the well. There's an event that takes place that draws him down into the well of the courtroom where the jury is. And this is the description that Kafka gives. The faces that surrounded him, tiny black eyes darted about, cheeks drooped like those of drunken men. The long beards were stiff and scraggly, and when they pulled on them, it seemed like they were merely forming claws, not pulling beards. Beneath the beards, however, and this was the true discovery that Kay made, badges of various sizes and colors shimmered on the collars of their jackets. They all had badges, as far as he could see. They were all one group, the apparent parties on the left and the right, and as he suddenly turned, he saw the same badges on the collar of the examining magistrate. Kay is shocked, and he shouts, "You're all officials. You're the corrupt band that I was speaking about. You've crowded in here to listen and snoop, and you've formed apparent parties and had one side applaud to test me. You wanted to learn how to lead innocent men astray." So what he hopes to be a fair-minded jury trial, we might almost say, turns out to be just an event completely controlled by this officialdom, by this bureaucracy that's in the background, and the hearing ends with Joseph K. leaving unsatisfied and more and more convinced that there is a dark organization behind his prosecution. Then there are a number of other episodes in the book. He finds his way into the offices of the law and meets some of the prosecutors of the law. And these are sort of a bureaucratic warren, one hallway leading after another. The air is stuffy. No light is allowed to get in. This is sort of the law, the inside of the law, or the prosecution. And then he's convinced that he needs to go talk to a lawyer. And he talks to a lawyer named Huld. And Huld is the character played by Orson Welles in the Orson Welles version of the trial. He is gives advice to Joseph K., basically tells him about the real world of legal practice or the courts in the city where they are in Prague, and basically says that nothing of what appears to be the ordinary legal procedures really take place. It's all about influence. All the decisions are made behind closed doors. The legal formality is not really respected. It's done. Everything is administered by an unknowable and isolated bureaucracy that can never really be influenced, or at least we don't really know that they can be influenced. Our best bet is that they can be influenced informally, but not through the ordinary legal procedures that that we usually engage in. Hull's nurse is a woman named Lenny. Lenny begins to try to seduce Kay. Again, this notion of the irrationality of sexuality is an important theme in the novel. A part of the sort of organic determinism of our psychic life. So, sexuality in the novel is basically another form in which we are imprisoned within this dark organic world. Lenny shows Kay some portraits of judges that she has in her room, and these are portraits done, it turns out, by a man named Titorelli, who's an artist. We'll hear about him later. What Lenny tells Joseph K. is, your only hope is to confess. Don't try to vindicate yourself. Don't try to be in it. Don't claim innocence. Your only hope is to confess, and I can only help you if you confess. So so K. leaves unhappy, and at first he was sort of dismissive of this prosecution, but he becomes increasingly concerned about it, to the point where he's obsessed with this. The prosecution that he is subject to, and he starts to write a kind of vindication of himself, and he starts to write, in a sense, an autobiography. But because he doesn't know what the law is, and he doesn't know what he's accused of, his autobiography is basically designed to prove that he has never done anything wrong at all, and of course that's impossible. So he's engaged in this impossible process of justifying his entire life because he's not sure what aspect of his life is the basis of this prosecution. One of his clients at the bank recommends that he go talk to Titorelli, who's the artist. And Titorelli has his studio in the second to the top floor of another one of these tenements. As Joseph K. comes to visit him, he's swarmed by a group of adolescent girls. Again, this sort of sexual undertow of the novel. He's finally able to get into Titorelli's room. Titorelli is a kind of court artist. He paints flattering paintings of judges. The judges look much more powerful than they are in reality. They're bigger than they are in reality. They rise up looking angry and intimidating in his paintings. And Titorelli admits that this isn't the way they look at all, but this is the way they want to be thought of as. And on the back of the throne of one of the judges, there is a statue or carving of justice, blindfold holding the scale, but on the heels of the figure of justice are wings. So the justice is mobile. She is more representative of the goddess of the hunt than she is the goddess of justice. And Titorelli explains to Joseph K. that no one is ever found guilty by the court. No one is ever found innocent by the court. But there are ways of sort of apparently gaining apparent acquittal, he calls it. And there are ways of delaying the proceedings indefinitely. such that you can remain alive, although you are always under the in the eyes or on the radar screen of the law, and you should give up hope of trying to establish your innocence, and all you can hope to do is survive, using every wile that you can, just as I survive as an artist, painting these pictures that really aren't art at all. They're just kitschy, flattering pieces that are designed to satisfy those who hold real power. So that's the course of the novel. At the end of the novel, Joseph K. is dragged off by two characters to a quarry outside the city. It's his 31st birthday. The prosecution began on his 30th birthday. And after this year has gone by, they bring him to the quarry and then engage in almost a sacrificial kind of murder. They plunge a knife through his heart. But before that, the second to the last scene is probably the greatest scene. It's probably the most often represented scene, and it's in the cathedral. Joseph K. goes to the cathedral because he expects to meet someone there. The person he actually meets is a priest. The priest explains to him that he is the court chaplain. So religion is allied with the state. So Joseph K. looks to the priest for some compassion, some guidance, some light in his situation. The priest basically says, I too belong to the law, and so you shouldn't expect anything from me other than what you would expect from a functionary of the law itself. So there is no distinct salvation, if you want, in the realm of religion. And the priest tells Joseph K. a parable, which is usually called Before the Law, and most folks say that this parable is the heart of the novel. The parable is very short. It goes this way. A man from the country wants access to the law, but his way is blocked by a doorkeeper who wears a fur coat and has a large, sharply pointed nose and a long, thin black Tatar's beard. The doorkeeper tells the man, I'm powerful, but I'm only the lowest doorkeeper. From hall to hall, however, stand doorkeepers, each more powerful than the one before. The mere sight of the third is more than I can bear. This doesn't seem right, says the man from the country. The law should be accessible to anyone at any time. And the man from the country continually begs admission, but dares not enter without the permission of the doorkeeper. He never receives it. The man languishes outside until his own death. No force is deployed against him. He is kept in ignorance of the law, it seems, only by his own inaction. K2 has been told throughout, by Huld and others, that action is impossible. Finally, the man from the country, as he dies, asks the doorkeeper why no one else has sought entrance through this gate. The doorkeeper sees that the man is nearing his end. And in order to reach his failing hearing, he roars at him, no one else could gain admittance here because this entrance was made solely for you. I'm going to shut it now. And then the priest and Joseph K. engage in this back and forth, trying to interpret the meaning of the parable. And it turns out there's no one resolution of the meaning, but it has a religious quality, has a political quality, and so that's in very inadequate outline the plot of the trial.
Maybe the best thing to do now is recount a story about a young man named David Saraceno who faced or sort of recount what he went through with the American justice system in 1994. And then we can use that as a lens to analyze the connections between the trial and the criminal justice system.
okay, there are a number of these kinds of examples in the course of the book, and there are unfortunately hundreds more that that can be found in other works. Saraceno was an 18-year-old high school student. There had been a fire that appeared to be an arson fire of some school buses in his area. And for some reason, he was arrested and interrogated, brought to the police station and interrogated with regard to the fire. He was kept there for about 10 hours. He denied any involvement, and the detectives, though, wouldn't accept his denials. We're not idiots. Don't bother wasting our time, was their response. And this basically follows the playbook of the interrogation manuals that are broadly used across the United States, the Reed Inbau interrogation manuals. Basically, the premise of it is begin with the premise that the person you're interrogating is guilty. Don't give him an opportunity to deny his involvement. The presumption of guilt prevails. So you are only going to tell us why and how you did what we already know you did. We're just going to get angry at you if you try to deny it. So they did that. They raised their voices for a long time. They lied to him about the evidence they had, also common practice in interrogation. They said his fingerprints had been found on the buses. They said that an accelerant, a chemical that allows fires to move more quickly, accelerant had been found on his boots. That was false. And when he tried to tell them that the boots belonged to his father, they said, we don't believe them either. We don't believe you on that either. He asked for an attorney. They said, you don't have a right to it. When his dad came down to the station to say, to make sure he had waived his right to an attorney, which is what the detective said, they said, yes, he had, which was false. They threatened him. We're going to throw you into jail unless you confess. It would be like throwing a lamb to the lions. You'll be raped when you're in the jail. Saraceno started to get too weakened to see spots. He became nauseous. The detective said, you're nauseous only because you know that you're guilty. If you concede your guilt, you'll feel much better. And eventually Saraceno said, well, do you want me to lie? As he was breaking down, he was crying uncontrollably. Is that what you're telling me to do? And one of the detectives said, well, you should do whatever you think is necessary and right. And at that point, and this has happened over and over again, he began to fabricate a story to satisfy the detectives, to get them to allow him to leave. And basically repeating and trying to weave into something vaguely coherent the details that the detectives had actually fed him. That confession was entered against him at trial, as is the case in about 80% of cases in which a confession is offered. The defendant was convicted, although a lot of other evidence pointed away from him. Justice Brennan remarked that really a confession is really the most powerful and devastating with prosecutions. Possible evidence. And while all this happened, and so he was convicted, and while his case was on appeal, the true perpetrators were discovered. Private investigators found that four others had actually set the fire. They had gotten a confession from one of them who agreed to testify against the other two, and that information was suppressed so that the courts and the lawyers who were prosecuting Saraceno were not aware that they had learned that there was another confession. But by this time, the statute of limitations for the bringing of the case against the others had run, and the prosecution basically continued to push the and resist the Saraceno's claim of innocence. Eventually, he was, when the information with regard to the other confessions came to light, his conviction was overturned. But the prosecutors threatened further prosecution of Saraceno unless he pled no contest to a lesser bus fire charge. when he refused, they, and this is really the most Kafkaesque aspect of this, they offered him a deal requiring him that he plead guilty to the misdemeanor of, quote, hindering prosecution by falsely confessing and receive a suspended sentence. And he took the deal because he just wanted to end this surreal prosecution, stop draining the family finances of to pay for lawyers to defend him. And so what happened was he pled guilty to making a false confession, which was coerced improperly by the detectives who were interrogating him in order to end the ordeal. And why did that all happen? Because they wanted some expression of fault or guilt from Saraceno so that they could deflect the charges against themselves. And so he was convicted of a relatively minor crime because of the misconduct of the agents of the prosecution. And that's an example of a lens through which you can see some of the Kafkaesque aspects of the American criminal justice system.
Could you go through now some of the fundamental issues in political and legal philosophy that appear in the trial and how these issues recur in a somewhat different key in our own legal system?
Yeah, the big argument at the time Kafka was a law student was between sort of two schools of thought. One was a sort of positivist school of thought that said the law should be clear and the rules should be sharp-edged and positivistic, that is, the judge should apply the law as written and should not go beyond the law that's written. So a kind of bureaucratic, what we would call mechanical jurisprudence on the one hand, and there were those who supported that understanding of the law. And then there was a notion that was supported by other of the theorists of the time, the so-called free law principle, that is, that a judge should be able to do the right thing, if you want, to consult his own moral intuitions without being overly constrained by the law. And we have a similar kind of argument that takes place today that supports between those who support what Justice Scalia calls the rule of law as a law of rules that support the benefits of the criminal law, especially being clear and predetermined and applied in a fairly mechanical way on the one hand, and those who support a set of procedures by which ordinary moral intuitions can be more relevant to especially criminal law determinations. And often that involves relying on the jury, which changes the whole picture. Now, what occurred in Germany and in Austria was that the notion of free law was made ideological by the judges on the courts under National Socialism. Those were the old old Prussian judges. They were conservative in their sensibilities, and they took this notion of relying not on the letter of the law but on one's moral sensibility and said the moral sensibilities are those that are dictated by the Nazi ideology. And so the sort of free law or discretionary theories were invoked after the rise of Hitler to justify the use of the criminal law for ideological purposes and for to execute basically Jews and anyone else who was viewed to be a wrong-thinking person in that they did not embrace the fundamental principles of National Socialism. So that's what gave that's how that free law discretionary principle came to be distorted in the Nazi era. And to anticipate where we can take a step back, but to anticipate what my final argument in the book is our reliance on the jury trial gives us a path through those that contrast between a mechanical jurisprudence on the one hand and a potentially bureaucratic and ideological application of mechanical application of pre-existent laws on the other, because the jury is not likely to be an ideological agent. They are laymen. There are 12 of them. They can rely on their moral intuitions in the sense that the free law notion hoped to advance without the expectation that they are adherents of a single ideology. So you're going to get a full elevation of common sense judgment that softens and renders the law more subtle and refined and more consistent with life world moral values. And that's an opportunity that Kafka's world did not have, because the jury had been abolished in Austria-Hungary in late 19th century. It was abolished in Germany in the 1940s. And so what the jury does is protects us against the making that kind of intuitive moral judgment that an important aspect of the application of the criminal law. It makes it a path that we have that they could not follow, that Kafka didn't know, and that was not available in Central Europe. Do you want me to try to describe in just sort of broad outline the way the characteristics of Kafka's law in the novel and how those are replicated in our law? There's a long chapter in the book in which I sort of go through the various aspects of our criminal justice system and say, in too many ways, it reflects what's worse about Kafka's law. Would that be helpful?
Yes, that would be great.
Okay. All right. So if I could just sort of go through them very, very quickly, what are the characteristics of the law? And it's often capitalized, the law in Kafka's novel. Okay. These are the main characteristics. It's unknowable. You can't know ahead of time what it is that it requires. And so the only way to avoid being the victim of the law is being perfect. And, of course, no one's perfect. And so everyone is subject to this unknowable law. It's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. And that's in the novel. We see law offices intertwined with tenement apartments and with Titorelli's studio. There's no escaping it. It's everywhere. It's bureaucratic. It's run by officials. So the room that Kay initially thought was filled with lay people is actually filled with officials. And the law is administered by these bureaucrats who function in this world, isolated from ordinary life, isolated from the light of day in this sort of warren of offices. It functions, it's informal. It does not take the formalities of the legal process seriously. It isn't bound by procedure in any kind of recognizable way. It relies on deception. The law is continually deceiving those that are subject to it. The function of defense counsel is marginalized. There's a little section in which basically Hull, the lawyer, sort of is ruminating about whether or not the defense is actually tolerated in the at all under this law. And there's a wonderful satirical episode in which the lawyer's room is described, and the lawyer's room is basically designed to dispirit the criminal defense bar and make them ineffective in actually representing the citizens that they're represented. The facts of the case are irrelevant. So you could, at first, you don't know what facts could be relevant because you don't know what the law is, and the judgment that the law is going to present seems to be casual about what the facts are about. The law is very interested in who you are, what kind of person you are, broadly speaking, not what you have done. The law is assimilated to the divinity. So the law functions like God. So the state functions in a divine kind of way. And so the kind of humility that is appropriate in the religious context and the basic principle that religion urges us to walk humbly before the Lord, that humility is manipulated into submission to the state. And the law takes advantage of that, our sense, our religious sensibility and our psychological weakness, especially if isolated and taken out of our ordinary roles, to dominate completely. And finally, the law tells us that it's necessary. There's a dialogue between Joseph K. and the priest in which Joseph K. says, "You can't really believe that I should submit to the court or confess to the court when I'm not guilty." And that would make lying into a universal system. And the priest says, "No, you don't have to accept the truth of what it is that the law is saying. You just have to accept its necessity." So it's inevitability. So those are the characteristics of the law in the book. And you want me to just try to summarize briefly the way in which our actual system relates to that?
Yes, that's perfect.
Okay. So there's one great scene in which Joseph K. is talking to Huld, and Huld basically says, "You've got to conceive of this, of the what it is that you face as a vast organism. It wastes your time to try to change anything. The only proper approach is to learn to accept existing conditions." So this is the necessity aspect of it. "Even if it were possible to improve specific details," which is an absurd superstition, "one would have at best achieved something for future cases, while in the process damaging oneself immeasurably by attracting the attention of an always vengeful bureaucracy. Don't attract attention. Try to realize that this vast judicial organism remains, so to speak, in the state of eternal equilibrium. So that if you change one thing on where you are, you can cut the ground out from where you are somewhere else. So it's unchangeable." Okay. So what are the characteristics of American law that are like this? I argue that large swaths of American law, both substance and procedure, are truly unknowable. That is, they are suffused with so much discretionary determinations by judges. They are so complex. There are so many rules and exceptions to rules and exceptions to rules that what appears to be the law really isn't. So in the whole area of search and seizure, the generalization that we should be safe and secure in our houses and persons and effects dies a death by 1,000 qualifications. The protection against interrogations and involuntary confessions also dies a death by 1,000 qualifications, such that the constitutional rules and the Miranda warnings are basically useless in practice. The law of evidence, as it applies in the trial, basically is so shot through with discretionary determinations that it really doesn't control or limit what it is the trial judge does. The substantive law of the substantive criminal law is so vast and addresses so many different aspects of our lives that one cannot but be violating the criminal law in virtually everything that you do. And if you want one example, the last three presidents of the United States have admitted that they violated our drug laws at one point or another, and they weren't prosecuted for that. Because the criminal law has been looked to as the go-to means to solve our social problems across such a wide swath of areas, that we now have a ubiquitous criminal law that any individual is dependent upon solely the good graces of prosecutors for not being prosecuted. So it's hard. It's impossible for an individual actually to know either the procedural law or the substantive law, criminal law, that he faces. It's bureaucratic. The police departments and the prosecutor's offices are highly bureaucratic. Sentences are set at a very high level of generality. Discretion is taken away from juries and judges in imposing sentences, such that these decisions with regard to sentencings are made at 35,000 feet and then imposed mechanically with truly awful results at the trial level. Deception, it's informal. Only 5% of our criminal cases go to trial. 95% of them are resolved, if you want to call it that, through bureaucratic means, through interrogation followed by plea bargaining. The Saraceno case shows that the devices by which confessions are extracted are highly informal. They rely upon psychological manipulation and deception. They rely upon our weakness, our psychological weakness when isolated and pressured with that kind of cagey strategic way. People are interrogated using, and courts permit this now, allowing the interrogators to deceive those who are being questioned. The jury is kept in the dark as to the consequences of their determination. They don't know what sentences are. The defense counsel is in many ways marginalized. There's some argument that this whole panoply of features of our criminal justice system are inevitable and can't truly be changed.
Could you briefly talk about the results of this Kafka system and the social background against which 1 in every 100 Americans is imprisoned?
Yeah. Here's a pretty good description of it. The practice of what's happened since the late 70s is a practice of controlling crime, doing justice, have had to adapt to an increasingly insecure economy that marginalizes substantial sections of the population, to a hedonistic consumer culture that combines extensive personal freedom with relaxed social control, to a pluralistic moral order that struggles to create trust relationship between strangers who have little in common, to a sovereign state that is increasingly incapable of regulating a society of individuated citizens and differentiated social groups, and to chronically high crime rates that coexist with low levels of family cohesion and community solidarity. The risky, insecure character of today's social and economic relations is the social surface that gives rise to our new, emphatic, overreaching concern with control and to the urgency with which we segregate, fortify, and exclude. So to the extent that our economic and social lives become more anarchic, become more atomistic, to that extent, the criminal law is looked to as the only reliable device by which to achieve some level of peace and security in society. So one author, Winifred Sullivan, has the argument that especially in, some particular states in this, the more the state is given to purely free market or neoliberal economics, and the less willing to devote resources to social services and to maintaining a labor force that isn't, whose salaries are not dictated solely by the free market. In those states, you have the most severe likelihood of a very harsh criminal justice system. You're more likely to have the death penalty. You're going to have a higher incarceration rate because that kind of economic and social acid that destroys the ties that individuals have to the community and the security those individuals have in being able to live a decent life, the social peace can be maintained, or so it's perceived, only through an especially harsh criminal justice system. And our economic system has something to do with that, and our religious tradition has something to do with that as well.
Okay. Now, could you offer us some antidotes to in the American, or some resources we have in the American criminal procedures tradition?
Yeah. Some of my reviewers, by the way, thought that the last part of the book, which offers some hope, was not as convincing as the part of the book that describes how dark our situation is. But I think it's important not just to end on a dark note. I think it's regardless of the likelihood of the countermeasures that we may have being successful, it's important to make those efforts. There are aspects of our tradition that were unavailable in Central Europe and unavailable to Kafka. One, as I said, is the institution of the jury. There, you can bring a non-ideological common sense to bear in the area of criminal justice system. That was much more the case in the early 20th century and late 19th century, before we began this politicized, bureaucratized expansion of the criminal justice system as we have it. So that's a resource that was unavailable to Kafka. In order to realize it, though, we have to have other, what one writer calls spaces of freedom, open up more opportunities for that institution to function. So 95% of our cases should not be resolved by interrogation followed by plea bargaining. More of them should be subject to the community values, community determination by local juries. But for that to happen, you've got to have legislatures and appellate courts on board. And we know that the both of those institutions are pressured by the influx of money into both the legislative process and into the process of an election of judges. It makes those forums, both legislatures and appellate courts, less and less free. They're not spaces of freedom anymore. They're subject to the same kind of deterministic pressures that Kafka satirized, so that legislators are not truly free because of the constraints under which they have to operate. More and more judges aren't free either, and studies have shown that the level of criminal convictions increases as the date for judicial elections approach. The Supreme Court has allowed money to pour into those races, and the Supreme Court has basically ruled as well that judges can campaign the same way that legislators can. Now, that could be viewed as just a fine practice of American democracy, but I view that as driven by determinants, financial determinants and economic determinants that render those forums unfree and render them no longer capable of making decent decisions with regard to the exercise of our criminal justice system. They become part of, as Kafka would put it, one vast organism whose determinants are economic and financial. And that's the struggle. To what extent can we bring some level of democracy and local moral judgment back into the criminal justice system when doing that requires a sign-on from appellate courts and legislatures that are increasingly under different practices, under different pressures. Also, you need the sign-in of prosecutors' offices, and prosecutors' offices have been themselves subject to these kinds of mass penal populism is the phrase, that is the success of using a harsher criminal justice as a campaign slogan, bureaucratized into the policies of prosecutors' offices. So those institutions, police departments, prosecutors, have got to become more democratized themselves. There have been some suggestions as to how that might be done. And they have to be more respectful of formality, of formalisms that protect individual rights when they deal with suspects in the criminal justice system.
Right. Well, I feel like we've only really scratched the surface on a very complex and important issue. So I would suggest to any listener that it would be very useful to actually read the book, because all these topics, Professor Burns goes into a lot more depth and analysis. But to conclude the interview, I'd love to know what you're working on now.
I've got a few projects going, all continuous really with this Kafka book. One is a consideration of the relationship between democracy and bureaucracy in the United States. What forms of social ordering must we rely on bureaucracies to effect for us, and what kinds of forums ought to be, in what kind of forums are available for sort of democratic input into our forms of social ordering. So what's the right balance, interpenetration of democracy and bureaucracy? And of course, this isn't just in the criminal justice area, but in lots of areas. So that's one set of issues. Another set of issues is this whole idea of what's called political theology, the relationship between religious sensibilities, religious themes, and the way we understand our relationship to the state. To what extent has the state hijacked religious ideals in its own purposes? What's the proper relationship between religious ideals and religious sensibilities and political ideals and political and legal sensibilities? That's number two. And number three is a long-term project on what you might call a theory of or a philosophy of procedure. What is procedure, and how should we what does procedure do for us? And in Kafka's book, there is no procedure. So what should procedure do for us? How should it function in the administrative context and the civil context of civil litigation and the context of criminal litigation? And what should it accomplish? And how can we make sure that decisions are fair decisions through the use of the artifice or artificiality of procedure? And how can we use procedure to elevate the determinations of ordinary people in juries and in other contexts as well? I think that's what procedure does. So our decisions are not just the plaything of mass journalism and propaganda. Our decisions are the result of a case that is actually presented in a fair way to ordinary citizens to make up their minds.
Well, those sound like extremely fascinating and I think very, very, very important works and things that we need to be thinking about. And I think, I know your reviewer said the hopeful part was less convincing, but I think acknowledging and analyzing these issues and trying to work through balancing bureaucracy and democracy are just extremely, that's hopeful that someone's doing that to me.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead, please.
No, I just appreciate those kind words, Siobhan.
I really want to thank you for being on the show today.
It's been delightful.
Thank you.